It included a regiment of 25-pounders, a battery of 5.5 medium guns, two heavy AK-AK batteries, plus one battleship, three cruisers, six destroyers, and bombs and cannons of 22 RAF squadrons, since much bloody fighting to take Akab had been anticipated. Jarrett set off once more, landed and collected the willing headman, leaving as batman Gunnar Carter as temporary military governor. Jarrett was awarded an MC to add to his DFC, which he'd won in 1944, flying for 17 Indian Division during the Manipur battles. The assault was to go ahead now, less the sea and artillery bombardment. D-Day was 3rd January 45. Three Commander Brigade went over from Foul Point, followed by 74 Brigade, led by 3rd 2nd Gurkhas. We landed at about 10:30 hours and reached our harbour area at Maithina village, 6 miles northwest of the seaport of Akab. Early on 4 January, we continued our march across the flat paddy fields. By midday, our patrols were entering the built-up area of Akab town. The town was a scene of destruction and decay after 2 years of RAF bombing. TAC HQ and my B Company moved to the police headquarter buildings in the centre of Akab, where we dug in. 2 days after our arrival, George Silcock, the battle second in command, had a nightmare, walked in his sleep and toppled out of a first-floor room in the police headquarters station and broke his neck on the ground below. He died in hospital in Akab 2 days later. Philip Panton and I had in fact visited him the day before he died and found him very perky, full of fun, and it was a great shock to everyone when we suddenly heard the news from the hospital that he'd gone. He is a particularly fine officer and had been Mike Calvert's number two in three column in 1943 on Operation Longcloth. A great, great loss. Apart from one patrol in LCAs, which I took up the western coast of eastern coast of Akab to a village called Palichong, we carried out relatively no patrolling at all, as it was plain to everyone that the Japs were nowhere to be found on the island, and there was little point in flogging the men who were already tired any further. On the evening of 10 January, Akab having definitely been declared free of enemy, Three Commander Brigade moved off in a varied fleet of frigates, sloops, minesweepers and coastal steamers and sailed further south. Their destination was Maibon Peninsula in Hunter's Bay. As I recall it, 3rd 2nd Gurkhas embarked on HMS Phoebe sometime on 11 January and sailed for Hunter's Bay and Maibon Peninsula. The dates in our regimental history and the dates in the divisional history do not tally and are, I think, inaccurate. I wrote regularly during this period, perhaps every week, every fortnight, to my mother, and I told her, as far as security permitted me to do so, to tell her what we were up to. And she has got a date written in her daily light to the effect that we landed on Maibon Peninsula on the 12th of January, whereas the divisional history and the regimental history gives it as the 13th of January, I think. But I was obviously well aware of my dates at the time, and when I wrote home, if I gave a date, it would be the exact date, so I'm assuming that perhaps for some reason or other the two histories I've just referred to do not give the exact date. Anyway, that is a small point, but my recollection is that it was 12 January and we splashed through the waves and set foot on Maibon Peninsula. At about an hour before HR on 12 January, this is according to the divisional history, 2nd Lieutenant Shibata, 54 Division's Recce Regiment, looked out from his bunker in Agnew Village on the southeast tip of Maibon Peninsula and made a note in his diary. Enemy ships rounding Kunchang Island. Enemy aircraft, single-engined, twin-engined and four-engined, are attacking. Looks as though there is going to be an enemy landing from the river. Shibata was one of about 30 Japs killed during the air bombardment by Mitchells and fighter bombers, which covered the initial landing. By first light on 12 January, Phoebe had anchored in Hunter's Bay, and we had been well looked after while we were on board, with the ship's officers surrendering their cabins to the British officers, so that we were able to have our first showers since leaving Razabil in early August. LCAs came alongside, and we scrambled down rope nets from Phoebe into the LCAs to land on Charlie Green Beach after the commandos in front of the village of Agnew. As we got into the LCAs, two Zeros came over and started to shoot up the commanders on the beach. As they did so, I think it was a P-14 Lightning. My aircraft recognition was not very good in those days. Came over and shot down both Zeros in flames. I was to meet the RAF pilot for the P-14 by chance when on leave in Kashmir the following May. And he told me that he had been the man with the finger on the trigger. We landed in front of Agnew without opposition, moved through the blasted Jap bunkers in the village and dug in on Pagoda Hill, which the commanders had earlier overrun. They themselves, as they were in the van, they had some very heavy fighting as they advanced up the peninsula. It was a narrow peninsula, and they reckoned that they didn't require any relief for the duration of the early phase of the operation. So for the next 3 days, we moved north up the Maibon Peninsula behind the commanders, who were fighting hard the while, to take a feature known as Rose, Maibon Village itself, Onion and Cabbage, assisted by the guns of HMIS Narbada, a squadron of Shermans of the 19th Lancers, and bombs and cannons of the RAF. As an aside here, I should mention perhaps that we were very, very conscious in those days of the limited support available to the infantrymen because of the war in Europe. Everything that was everything went there rather than to us in the forgotten army. And there was many a time when we would have been overjoyed at receiving the support that the troops in Europe were getting before taking out an enemy position. With us, it was a question of bang, bang, bang from artillery, a few rounds, and no more, because there was nothing else to be made available. And the result was, of course, infantry casualties were probably greater than they would, under normal circumstances, have been. But the war in Europe was deemed to be the most important, and therefore everything went there rather than to us. But it must have been infuriating for senior commanders in Burma to have to make do with so little, relatively speaking. A marked Japanese map showing all enemy positions on the peninsula had been captured in Agnew by the commanders, which was of great help after translation during the rest of the Maibon fighting. On Cabbage, the commanders overran the HQ of the Jap Maibon Defence Force, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Nakamura, who was the CO of 54 Div Recce Regiment. As always, the captured Jap defences were expertly constructed and sited. One day, when the CO was calling, giving out orders to his O group, I was not present, fortunately, at the time. Jap harassing fire caught them in where was it now? It is in an open paddy field, I think, if I remember correctly. And our doctor and a captain, Fidders Clark, were both very, very badly wounded, and were dispatched once to hospital, never to be seen again. I believe another subaltern was hit, but I'm not too certain about that. But the loss of our doctor, in particular, was significant. He was, in fact, replaced very quickly, but It was sad to see him go. After the commanders had taken Bugle, just south of Kanthachong, at the northern neck of the peninsula, 32nd Gurkhas were ordered to take up the advance guard. By now, most men and most companies were lousy. We hadn't had lice on us since the Wingate expedition, but they were returning now because of our dirtiness. It was now the night of 15-16 January. General Wood came forward to tell Philip Panton to take out Point 262 across the Kanthachong and just north of Kantha village. At first light on 16 January, we crossed Kanthachong and dug in Kantha village. My B Company was dug in on the west flank of the battalion position. D Company moved forward to recce 262, and 11 men were hit during the reconnaissance. One rifleman, Kariman Rai, was badly hit when he was far forward during this probe. A further 5 men were hit trying to rescue him. He had, as a result, had to be left out all that night. And when Kariman was eventually rescued the following day, he was still alive, but he'd been bayoneted and left for dead by the Japs. 262 was held by about a company of 54 Division Recce Regiment, and had 2 75mm regimental guns dug in bunkers and sighted to cover our initial landing at Agnew, plus 1 4-inch mortar, or 81mm mortar to be exact, which was also dug in a bunker. No overhead cover. Once we were across the Kanthachong, we were subjected to regular harassing fire from the Jap 75s and the 4-inch mortar on 262. Throughout the night of 16-17 January, Jap patrols were constantly probing our positions. I put my company at 50% sand 2, and no doubt other rifle companies were doing the same. We had little sleep. D Company left Kantha at 1300 on 17 January and deployed to assault 262. On reaching the summit of the feature, they found the main Jap defences were centred round a broken brick stump of a pagoda, under which a complex bunker had been dug. The hole was on a knife-edged ridge covered with scrub and jungle. To support D Company, there were 2 Hurricanes and a troop of Shermans from 19th Lancers under Captain Robin Wright. First, the Hurricanes came in to make run after run over 262 to blast the Jap positions with cannon fire. Those of us watching from Kantha got burnt time and time again from the falling red-hot fired cases. Then followed a 25-pounder concentration on the objective. We had a grandstand view of D Company's attack from Kantha across the open paddy fields. The shattered pagoda bunker position stood out red and clear like a sore thumb in the bright sunlight. Infantry and tanks advanced up the hill together as far as possible, with Robin Wright on foot outside his tank in order to get a clearer position of the battle, a clearer picture of the battle, and to direct his tanks far more easily. This is the only time the battalion had support from air, armour, and guns at the same time. Never again. The battle raged for about 2 hours, during which, at one stage, all of us, including our brigadier, George Hurst, saw 2 Gurkha other ranks win the Indian Order of Merit in front of our very eyes. First, Rifleman Dalsing Tapper, though severely wounded, could be seen dragging his Bren gun up onto the top of the shattered red pagoda. The bunker underneath the pagoda must have been captured by this stage, and the enemy at whom Dalsing was directing his Bren fire must have been a counterattack force. Then Dalsing's platoon commander was seen as scrambling up onto the top of the pagoda, alternately firing and reloading his Tommy gun, then hurling broken bricks from the pagoda onto the advancing Jap counterattackers. We could clearly see Havildar Bhupo Singh Ali laying about the enemy without any thought of his own safety. 262 was no more than 400 yards away from where I was standing, and using my binoculars, I could see every movement made by Dalsing and Bhupo. It was much more exciting than seeing Errol Flynn, Little Bighorn, on the big screen. At 15:30, the position had been won, and at a very low cost of 9 wounded. D Company now dug in. My B Company moved from its position from the west flank of Canter to dig in on the village's northeast corner, covering the paddy fields between Canter and 262. My 5 platoon under Jemadar Chandrabir Tapo was told to probe forward after last light on 17 January. 5 platoon's mission was to move north through the paddy to the west of 262 to see whether any Jap counterattack force was forming up in order to assault our D Company on the captured objective. Whilst 5 platoon were advancing north, a Jap party, estimated at 50 in strength, first staged a jitter party and then a full-blown counterattack on 262. David Olbrini, the company commander, called for his artillery DFs to be fired. Unknown to us, as far as I can recall, one of these tasks was the area of paddy through which Chandrabir was leading 5 platoon. Chandrabir called me on the radio and told me what was happening. I asked him if Japs were in his locality. He said that he'd seen none. The DF fire was coming down within yards of 5 platoon's position, so I told him to withdraw hot foot. And then I spoke to Philip Panton on the telephone to tell him what I had done. The Japs were probing my company front all night, and they also mounted 3 more counterattacks on D Company on 262. We had 100% stand-to that night, all night long, so no one got any sleep. The following morning, I took a patrol to 262 to visit David O'Greeny and examined the enemy positions, the 2 spiked M75 spiked by the Japs, and also the undamaged 4-inch mortar. David said 62 Japanese bodies had been found on the position. On the afternoon of 18 January, 1410 Baluch passed through us and continued north, having several clashes with the enemy. On 19 January, Pagauk was occupied by the Baluches, and 6 oxen bucks were moved northeast across the Punche Chong and later secured Zinyamar, where they were able to dominate the Dangbong Chong with anti-tank fire. The Royal Navy motor launchers had numerous successes in the Chongs between Maibon and Tumandu to the south, sinking some 14 Jap launchers. On 22 January, at 1300 hours, 3 Commando Brigade landed from the Dangbong Chong to make a beachhead at Kangor, some 4 miles east of Point 262. On 23 January, 51 Brigade, led by 8 19th Hyderabads, landed on the Kangor beachhead. By about 17 February, the bitter battle of Kangor was over. The Japs of 54 Division had been severely defeated. They had suffered over 2,000 casualties and lost 26 field guns. 3 Commander Brigade and 51 Brigade suffered 210 killed and 750 wounded, light in comparison to the Jap casualties. And our Reggie Hutton won a bar to his DSO. Meanwhile, my B Company had moved northeast from 262 to dig in on the Cocktail Ridge. On 20 January, I took 5 platoon and an FOO south down the ridge towards the Maibon River. We bumped a Jap force en route, and one rifleman was hit in the thigh. Thinking the enemy party was dug in, we pulled back and I told the FOO to hit the Jap position with every available gun at his disposal. This turned out to be only a troop of 25-pounders. After ranging, the FOO fired his guns for 2 minutes, after which we went into the bayonet. The enemy had withdrawn. There had only been a standing patrol, apparently, on the ring contour, rather than a dug-in position. Light was fading, so we withdrew to the company position, carrying the wounded rifle. The following day, I took another fighting patrol south down the spur. This time, I took 4 platoon. No contact was made. During our return, however, my leading scout signaled enemy and also a hut on the eastern slope of the ridge. I went forward with the leading section commander, having halted the platoon on the ridge. I saw the hut just ahead. It is a bamboo basha and quite small. It had a door entrance facing me, and I thought I could see a Jap lying on his back in the doorway. I checked my binoculars, and sure enough, it was indeed a Jap lying on the ground, chest uppermost. He looked as though he was wounded. I beckoned the platoon commander, Jemadar Gunja Singh Gurung, forward and told him to give me covering fire, and took the section commander forward with me to do a recce. I took a 36 grenade from my belt, tucked my Tommy gun onto my left arm, pulled the pin from the grenade, and put the pin between my teeth and my mouth. The section commander, Lance Nag Bisram Tapa, and I advanced very cautiously from cover to cover until we were close enough to see that the Jap in the doorway was almost unconscious. I then charged into the hut through the doorway with Bisram and Sport behind me. There were bamboo bunks along each wall and about six dead Japs lying on them. We examined the wounded Jap in the doorway, who was suffering from multiple shell or mortar shrapnel wounds, all of which were gangrenous and seething with maggots. The hut was obviously a tiny field hospital. We checked for documents. There was none. We always carried a blanket or bamboo pole stretcher with all platoon fighting patrols. So we put the wounded Jap on the stretcher and returned to the company position as quickly as possible. The wounded prisoner was then sent to TAC HQ nearby. He died during the night before he could be interrogated. He was the only Jap soldier we ever captured. On 22 January, I took out another fighting patrol, 5 platoon again, and went south down the ridge once more. This time, we intended to go to its southernmost tip, overlooking the Maibon River, to check if the Japs were dug in covering the river. 20 or so yards from the southern tip of Cocktail Ridge, my leading scout, Rifleman Harkavala Chetri, looked round at me and signalled enemy in front. The platoon commander, Jemadar Chandrabir Thapa, and I crawled forward on our bellies under cover of the forward Bren gunner. I saw a solitary Jap standing in a foxhole, facing away from me and looking out over the river. He was wearing a steel helmet and was manning a medium machine gun. He was looking out on the river through a gap in the trees, which must have been about 50 yards ahead of him and below him. I looked at Jemadar Chandrabir and mimed that I would throw a grenade into the MMG foxhole and that he should stand by with his Tommy gun ready to fire. He nodded agreement. I pulled the pin out of a grenade taken from my belt. Ideally at close range, the foxhole was only 5 to 6 yards to my front. I should have released the lever of the grenade, then waited for 2 seconds before throwing so as to achieve an instant explosion on the grenade falling into the foxhole. However, I thought if I were to do so now, the Jap gunner would hear the click of the strike of the striker hitting the detonator and would have ample time to turn his MMG round on us. I did not realise at the time just how heavy a Jap MMG is, and there would have been little opportunity in the time available of his being able to take such counteraction. I looked all round before throwing my grenade to see if there were any neighbouring Jap positions. I could see none. I lobbed the grenade into the foxhole. Then the Jap looked down, saw what was at his feet, shot straight into the air like a jack-in-the-box, and rolled down the forward slope, followed by bursts from Chandravir's TSMG, and out of our sight. Lady Luck must have been with him on that morning. A second after the Jap had left from the foxhole, my grenades exploded on thin air. However, the MMG was ours. It now stands in the Gurkha Museum in the Peninsula Barracks in Winchester. We searched the whole area for our Jap target, but he was not to be found. I often wonder if he's alive today. He certainly deserves to be. There was no sign of any other enemy positions in the area. How could a solitary MMG and a single gunner be located so far away from friendly support? We puzzled over this time and time again, but no one could come up with the answer. It was most unlike the Japs to leave a man with a valuable piece of equipment unsupported. Well, we took our prize back to our company position and sent it the following day to TAC HQ after test firing it ourselves. The afternoon after it had arrived at TAC HQ, the CO saw one of the officer's mess orderlies, Pemba Tamang, and one of his mates, both dressed up in Jap-type uniform and peak caps made up for themselves, carrying the MMG in triumph round the TAC position. Had Philip not told them to stop larking about, they could well have been shot for their prank, so realistic was their disguise. B Company then moved further east to another north-south running ridge overlooking the Punche Chong. To our east, about 2 miles away, we could clearly see the Kangor beachhead. A troop of medium guns were located just below our position to provide supporting fire for 51 Brigade at Kangor. One afternoon while we were on this ridge, one of my platoons, 4 platoon, called me to their perimeter to tell me that a Jap had been seen moving along northwards, just below our ridge position. As I waited, and with the man who had seen the Jap originally. And sure enough, a short while later, an IP soldier with a peaked cap on, carrying a pack, a rifle slung over his shoulder, could be seen, oh, about 50 yards away, moving along the bottom of our position. Well, we could have killed him there and then, quite easily, but I thought, if this is a forerunner of a large Jap party, the longer we waited, the more we would kill. So we waited and waited, our Jap disappeared, and no one else turned up, so we were without a target in the end. But it was always interesting to us to be able to study the enemy calmly and at close range. The Jap soldier always had a very great fascination for us, and it was a thing we all loved to do when the situation allowed, to look carefully at our enemy, examine his clothing and equipment, and that sort of thing. But on this occasion, sadly, I made the wrong decision and allowed him to go free.
Did the fascination consist merely in the fact that he was the enemy?
Yes, he was the enemy, and he was such a special enemy. He put the fear of God into us time and time again, and it was a sort of a nervous fascination, I should think, that that turned most of us on. But no doubt all enemy of repute can fascinate one. It wasn't only the Japanese, but certainly for my money they were the most potent foe we ever encountered in subsequent campaigns after the war. They were so very much better than so many of our own troops. Now, as I said, we could see from this ridge position the Kangor beachhead. And in particular, we could pick out quite clearly a long, low feature known as Point 170, where very heavy fighting had taken place. In fact, on one occasion, a second Lieutenant Noland of the Norfolks, attached to No. 1 Army Commando in the 3 Commando Brigade, won a posthumous VC on that particular feature. I never saw his full citation, but the story came back to us that he'd repelled virtually single-handed at least 3 counterattacks on his troop position, and on one occasion was seen firing a 2-inch mortar from the hip of the enemy to repel them, which was quite an effort. A kick of a 2-inch mortar could have so easily, if he'd had the base plate on his hip, he'd have broken his hip bone. But obviously, he must have held it in such a way that he got away with his trick. But he was clearly a very, very brave young man and thoroughly deserved his Victoria Cross. It was sad that it had to be posthumous. Another interesting episode which took place